And we're looking at the verses from text number 25 in the 8th chapter. So how are we going with our reading? Doing okay? Over and out. Who's keeping up? Who's finding it difficult? Yeah. I thought you'd be way ahead. You're one of the first ones to. Hey. Who's read up to chapter 33? Text number 33. Yeah. Okay. Okay. And who's had a look at chapter 9, verses 11. Yeah, it's good. Okay. There's a lot going on now, because we've got John Mastermy, and I'll make a few excuses for you, just to make you feel better. John Mastermy, you know, Brother Rams of PSA, Rad Astermy. Too much gay in the Sadji. Yeah. read as much as you can, and what we'll do is we're doing lesson 3 of the 5 lessons in this unit 3. We're doing unit 3, there's 5 lessons, and we're up to the 3rd lesson. So we'll have 2 more lessons, and that will finish chapters 8 and 9. And then we'll be halfway through the first canto. At the end of this unit, what we'll do is we'll have one session, and we'll do this from now on, actually. We'll just have one session which we're going to just devote to just make sure that everyone's has a good understanding of all the homework, the Purva Svadhyaya questions they should have answered, make sure that if they have answered them, they've got the correct understanding, just to check what they've got, and also just to make sure that you have a good understanding of what you need to do, you know, for the essays. So we'll have 2 more lessons, and we'll finish up this section, and then the 3rd one we'll have a revision, and then so 4 weeks from now we'll be looking at a test. But we will be going over it quite thoroughly in that revision, and I thought, you know, especially because for a lot of devotees they have so many other services, and of course just with this temple there's always something going on that people can't always attend, so we'll do that as a permanent thing from now on. So don't be too alarmed, but still, does everyone get to hear the class session, at least on the internet?
The internet is not working.
What's that?
No, I was listening.
You've been listening?
The
last
one was
last week's was not there.
Not up there.
Not up there.
Because I have a problem anyway, then everything. But the website is not working this morning.
Okay.
A couple of why were the lectures I'm trying to receive?
Yep.
I could not
even
download.
It will go up. Yep. Okay.
It's working in general.
I always
find
it
sometimes
get this,
but
it's
not.
You
should come to
your
house and listen.
Yeah.
I could not
hear.
So what was the last one you heard?
From 14th of August.
Okay, so, yeah.
And 7th of August was also there.
Yeah,
was
thank you. Yeah.
Maybe it's, if you just listen there, maybe it's not good, but I downloaded it and listened really on my mobile.
Last week we actually had a look at the chronology of Srimad Bhagavatam, how we looked at how it's not written in a chronological order, and we discussed this in comparison to to the Mahabharata. So I won't go into it now. When it's posted, have a listen to that. Very interesting discussion. So you probably wouldn't have missed much as far as our scheduled class, which the scheduled verses that we meant to look at, we didn't really, it was more of a revision session. But it's a very interesting understanding of the Srimad Bhagavatam. One of the things, of course, is because Nanda asked me the other day about, why they would not kill Ashwatthama, and then he came back and threw the other Brahmastra. And of course, if you look at the chronology of it, according to the Mahabharata, the event all happened simultaneously, whereas as we're reading it in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it comes up that as Queen Kunti's Krishna's on his chariot and about to depart for Dwarka, and then Ashwatthama throws his second lot of Brahmastras. But if you read it in the Mahabharata, actually it all happened, then he was punished, and a lot of other things happened. It was many months before, after, Bhishma, it was a couple of months. Bhishma, I think it was about, nearly 2 months, till Bhishma Dev actually left his body. So many, and then, Queen Kunti at the end, when Krishna was about to leave, she offered her prayers for that. So but the way we see it in the Bhagavatam, it's almost like as she was offering her prayers, Ashwatthama threw his weapons. But there was action, but you can actually take it exactly as it's stated in the Bhagavatam as well. Because, as Prabhupada mentions in the ninth chapter, in one of the purports there, that the devotees, Sukadeva Goswami, Prabhupada, the devotees who relish the Srimad Bhagavatam, they're more interested in the content of the topics than the chronology. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you'll see that in Nectar Devotion, Srila Prabhupada mentions that when at the time Queen Kunti was speaking with Krishna, then Ashwatthama, there was that saga. She'd witnessed that saga with Ashwatthama. So Srila Prabhupada comments just exactly as it's written in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Not considering the chronology, or if you want to consider the chronology, you can look at how it's described in the Mahabharata to get some idea of the chronology, And at the same time, you have to keep in consideration that these events happen not in the linear time that, you know, we see everything in terms of linear time measurements, but these events are happening in different universes, in different dimensions that, you know, we can't quite consider. There's actually a purport in the ninth chapter of the describing the past times of Bhishma. It's somewhere around about 12 or 13 and text 12 or 13 or something. Srila Prabhupada specifically mentions, you know, that these things are happening in dimensions and time scales that we're not familiar with, and therefore it is not incorrect to say that just to take the Bhagavad Gita exactly as Sukadeva Goswami is speaking it, and at the same time there are other chronologies mentioned. You can take it either way as you prefer. You know, to give an example, in one universe when Krishna performs his pastime, you know, Ashwatthama, someone playing that role, may kill the five sleeping sons of Draupadi, but there may not even be a second incident of, you know, trying to kill the child within the womb. You know, there are slight differences within, you know, the pastime sometimes. So, you know, there are several examples within the Srimad Bhagavatam where Sukadeva Goswami discusses events as almost as its one dialogue, and yet it changes from events that happened in this millennium to something that happened in the previous manu. But it's all just in one story. You know, there's no attempt to make it chronological, but the content, there's a flow in Sukadeva Goswami's content, you know, the instruction that he wants to give us, there is a flow on in that, and that is more important than the time scale. So it's not wrong to take it as it is in the Bhagavad Gita, and at the same time it's not wrong to see that there are other chronologies mentioned in Puranas and Mahabharata, like that. So we had a big discussion on that last week, and then we looked at Queen Kunti's prayers which she offered to Krishna at the time he was leaving for Dwarka. We looked at verses 18 to 24. Just to briefly go over those. Queen Kunti said, O Krishna, I offer my obeisances unto you because you are the original personality and unaffected by the qualities of the material world. You exist in both within and without everything, yet you are invisible to all. So she's describing that Krishna is completely transcendental. And although he is completely transcendental, he's not observed by others. People don't know God. That's what she's saying. God is everywhere within and without, and yet people don't know him and they cannot see him. Why cannot see him? She says in verse 19, because you are beyond the range of limited perception, sense perception. You are the eternally irreproachable factor covered by the curtain of deluding energy. You are invisible to the foolish observer, exactly as an actor dressed as a player is not recognized. So he's covered in a disguise. What is that disguise? He appears like an ordinary human being. she describes his appearance. You yourself descend to propagate the transcendental science of devotional service unto the hearts of advanced transcendentalists and mental speculators who are purified by being able to discriminate between matter and spirit. How then can we women know you perfectly? So there, of course, she's describing that Krishna is not an ordinary person taking birth according to the laws of karma in order to suffer the results of his sinful activities and enjoy, you know, the results of his pious activities. He's descending as a pastime out of his mercy to give transcendental knowledge of the science of devotional service to those who are disinterested in material life. And although Queen Kunti perfectly understands that, you know, she's, in her humility, she's saying, how can we women know you perfectly? And in that mood, she's demonstrating, she's showing that she understands the nature of Krishna's transcendental nature and appearance, and we can see from her example that that humble mood of a devotee is what attracts Krishna to reveal himself to them. She offers obeisances and to the Lord and glorifies his pastimes. Let me therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto the Lord who has become the son of Vasudeva, the pleasure of Devaki. The boy of Nanda and the other cowherd men of Vrindavan and the enlivenment of the cows and the senses. So here she's saying people do not know God, they're covered by the deluding energy, but he descends to show who he is. That's the nature of his appearance. And who is he? How does he reveal himself? He reveals, here I am, I'm Krishna, I'm the son of Vasudeva and Devaki, foster child of Nanda, and he enjoys in the company of the cowherd people of Vrindavan, and his mission is to protect the Vedic culture, and protecting Vedic culture is particularly done through cow protection and protection of the Brahmanas. So she reveals, here is God, it's Krishna, and here are his activities. So in that verse there can be no mistake who she's saying is God. There's no mention of Sai Baba or Vivekananda or this one or that one. No, none of those things. So then she says, my respectful, again, you know, continuing to offer obeisances to the Lord in his pastimes. My respectful obeisances unto you, O Lord, whose abdomen is marked with a depression, like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus, and whose feet are engraved with lotuses. Further, very specific description of the Lord. There are many people who claim to be God and do not have any of these features. I think there are eight parts of the body of the Lord which can be compared with lotus flowers.
What do they mean with compared with lotus flowers?
Well,
is it shape or
shape?
Kind of mark on the skin?
He has the on I think the feet he has you know, the lines form a lotus flower. You know, what you don't want to see there is a crow or a rat. If you see that on the feet of someone, you probably, you know, got jewelry down in your midst, or, you know, something like that. But they are auspicious. I used to, when I was on the farm with the children, one of the classes I used to teach was how to recognize the different features of the body from, you know, top to bottom. You know, the eyebrows and the nose, and, you know, to the feet and the hands. And we used to, you know, look like that. And so all the children used to look at each other's feet to see all the different marks, you know, flags and lotuses and that. So, you know, you find that devotees have some of these features, auspicious features. Krishna has, you know, certain ones. To be Krishna, all those specific features must be there, and must be very clear and very beautiful like that. The eyes, you know, sort of lotus petal eyes, coming nice large lotus petal eyes. Navel like a lotus flower. Lotus garlands. So, you know, there must be some. It's not just flattering. It's not empty flattering. When you see, you know, the features of Krishna, it should be quite evident. Gee, you know, how beautiful, you know, that this feature of Krishna's body is, and I can see how they can compare, you know, to a lotus. We're not just saying because lotus is a beautiful, yes, Krishna has a beautiful navel. You know, there is some comparison in the shape, the beauty, the colour, and different things like that. So again, you know, it's a very you know, we do a police sketch, you know, when someone's robbed the bank or something. So that's a quick sketch of some of Krishna's features, which should be obvious in the person who's claiming to be Krishna. O Hrishikesh, master of the senses and lord of lords, you have released your mother Devaki, who is long imprisoned and distressed by the envious king Kamsa, and me and my children from a series of constant dangers. So, and then in verse 24, she also describes that, my dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poison cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from the vicious assembly, from sufferings during our exile in the forest, and from the battle where great generals fought, it's the battle of Kurukshetra, and now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashwatthama. So, which brings us up to today's verse. So there, we see that the Pandavas always depended upon Krishna for protection, and she is revealing that they depended upon him only, and he did protect them, and that was very, very kind of him. Now, of course, Krishna is about to depart, and we have to remember that the whole mood of her prayers is that we don't want you to go. So you see here that she's offered her, you know, she's approached Krishna very respectfully, because she knows he's God, and she's pointing that out to, you know, everyone who happens to be assembled. At, you know, so many people come to see Krishna leave, and she is pointing out in her prayers. Of course, Queen Kunti, and everyone will be listening very attentively, because Queen Kunti is the mother of the Pandavas. You know, and it's, you know, it has been mentioned by various saints and sages that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They have, some have witnessed, some have heard so many different pastimes. Now Krishna is about to depart, and Queen Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas, who's been through them, you know, from the very beginning, right the way through, right up to the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, and she's offering her final, you know, prayers to Krishna. Everyone will be listening very intently. You know, what is she saying to Krishna? You know, if anyone knows Krishna, you know, she does. What is she saying? So, So she's made it very clear to everyone present that here is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it was He who is the Supreme Lord who protected us, you know, in all the times of trouble, right back since as far as she can remember. Which leads her to the real point of what she wants to say is now, she's saying in verse 25, I wish that those calamities would happen again and again, so that we would see you again and again, for seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. So we're going to discuss this a little bit. We're going to ask the question, let's try and explain why Queen Kunti considers the calamities welcome. Let's have a look at that. And it's also connected with verse 26 as well, that topic of calamities being welcome continues into verse 26. She says, my lord, your lordship can easily be approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. Alright, let's write on the board here. Maybe we'll write on that one over there. Who wants to be a scribe? Can you reach up there?
Who wants it?
He's always standing on the chair. Okay. Why does Queen Kunti consider calamities to be welcome?
Gives an opportunity to remember God.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Gives. You can put it at your height, or you can stand on the chair.
Probably here, in high education means material currently PhD.
Yeah.
Is that? Yes, this is an opportunity to remember Krishna. And
one more thing is that making it easy, there is no help as desperate.
What's that?
One have a desperate need, because in calamities nothing can help. So one feels desperation.
There's a sense of desperation in calamities. Okay. Why don't you write the hard words for him? Yeah. Do you want him to help? He do some, you do some? Yeah. You just do some of the bigger ones. So So you think Queen Quinty likes the adrenaline rush? Or is it desperate, being put into that situation of desperation?
She's desperate for help, so that intensifies the devotion.
It intensifies the devotion and the remembrance of Krishna.
Makes the devotees dependent on the Lord for protection.
Okay, so you might have to write some of these too. Yeah? You write one, he'll write one. So
even though there's a calamity, no?
Yeah.
One need not have to depend on the Lord. There are so many other intoxications, other things. So there are alternatives also there. The material world, I'm just saying, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So one need not have to, see these days what's happening is, there is a problem, straight away they take shelter of whatever, maybe intoxication or something, you know. So unless one is fine, you know, the little bit piety should be, otherwise it's not easy to drink.
So if there's a problem, usually they throw money at it.
Yes, it's easier.
In the Western world, there's a problem, throw some money at it. Let it go. Alright, what have we got? You got everything?
Yes, remember, makes us dependent on Krishna, we feel no one else can help.
There is a desperation.
And desperation?
It gives us the intensity of devotion.
Gives us the intensity of feeling. Gives us intensity of feeling. Of feeling, isn't it? Gives us intensity of feeling towards Krishna.
So should we go before the deities and pray for calamities?
For calamities?
Yes. We should? What calamities are you praying for at the moment?
Crash on the computer.
Eh? I'm praying for computer crash.
He shouldn't cry
in front of the deity. Shouldn't cry. No, he's not crying because we're welcoming the calamities.
Yeah. Even from challenging situations, challenging service, so where we can depend on Krishna
to
execute the service.
Okay. That's what you're praying for? More of a challenge? I'll send you to Russia to distribute books. Okay. Does anyone feel find it difficult to understand Queen Quinty's mood? And
it's difficult, very high consciousness, because we pray to God to take away the problems.
Mm.
I never say I can't do even after that, because I cannot pray now, please leave the problem. It is very high consciousness.
Queen Quinty these when personalities such as the Pandavas and Queen Kunti appear, sometimes the various demigods appear along with a Nikshasiddha devotee. Was it Pandu? I think it might be Pandu. It was considered to be Swayambhuva Manu, appeared along with his wife Satchavati or something like that. So, and the same with the Pandavas. You know, each of the Pandavas is considered to be, you know, one of the particular demigods has appeared. So they're a partial expansion of some of those particular demigods. And at the same time, so you know, so for instance, Arjun, I've got a little quote here somewhere. I'm not sure if it's in this book. It may not be here. They have some of them have Nitya Siddha identities, and at the same time certain demigods will also appear, you know, within the body of that same person. When the pastimes are finished, the particular demigods go back to the heavenly planets, and sometimes the Nitya Siddhas go back to the spiritual world, sometimes the Nitya Siddhas also go back to the heavenly planets, and we see that, that, you know, at the very end of the Mahabharata, all the Pandavas are there in heaven, and they asked, I think it might have been Narada Muni, Yudhisthira asked, how long will we stay here in heaven? I think Yudhisthira is saying, how long will my brothers and my mother stay in heaven? And he said, not very long, because as soon as Krishna, you know, will go to another world to perform his particular pastimes, you will all go with him. So these personalities like Kunti, just as Arjun will continually travel with the Lord, then you know, Kunti will travel with them, and you know, Yudhisthira, you know, they will travel together, and you know, in the event that such personalities return back to the spiritual world, then you know, there is you know, either a Nitya Siddha or someone who is being elevated to a Nitya Siddha position will actually take that role. So it's, you know, we consider that the Nitya Siddhas, in the sense that if they were not Nitya Siddhas previously, that they would have been elevated to that position, you know, in that lifetime. You know, we know that Arjun, of course, Krishna said to Arjun in the Bhagavad Gita that, you know, many millions of years ago I spoke to the sun god. As Srila Prabhupada explains, that you know, you don't remember that, which means that you know, that I remember that. Prabhupada explains that Arjun was present. You know, these are eternal pastimes. So, yeah, you would consider them Nitya Siddha, but you would also have to consider that, you know, there are millions and millions of universes, and Krishna does perform these pastimes. When he winds up one pastime in this universe, of course, he begins that pastime in another universe. But then we have to consider that, you know, Arjun, if Arjun is in this universe for millions of years performing his pastime with Krishna, then it's, you know, for Arjun to then perform the pastime of the Battle of Kurukshetra in another universe, he'd have to pop out of that universe and then pop back to this universe to wait around for millions of years for the next pastime. So there are, you know, Krishna performs his pastimes with these devotees in many, many, many universes, which means there are, you know, many Arjuns and many Queen Kuntis and many, you know, Devakis and Vasudevs and what have you. So they're Nityasiddha, and sometimes those Nityasiddhas return to the spiritual world, and others may be elevated to that position, or other Nityasiddhas may take that role in a particular universe. And at the same time, you will read descriptions where, you know, the Pandavas were these particular demigods, and Queen Kunti was this, you know, particular demigod. So that is also true, because just like Arjun, you know, Arjun is considered to have appeared as Ramananda Roya, but also it's considered that Vishakha Devi also appeared within the form of Ramananda Roya. Haridasa Kaur is considered an incarnation of Lord Brahma, and sometimes they also consider the Prahlad Maharaj. But you know, but both can be there. So you say, you know, is are they Nityasiddha with, you know, appearing, you know, within the form of Arjun within that pastime? Can be a Nityasiddha and also a demigod who will actually return to the heavenly planets. And a Nityasiddha, you know, as Arjuna is considered to be Nara, you know, Nara Narayan, so Arjuna may return to meditate with Nara Narayan Rishi, and the particular demigod that was also there within that pastime will go somewhere else to the heavenly planets. Yep.
Just asking regarding this verse, because Prabhu was pointing out, if somebody who is not biased, he can't approach Krishna. He takes shelter of some other means. It's like Prabhu was mentioned, if he's not biased, one cannot approach the Lord. He is becoming a communist or something like that. He's referring to the four types of people who surrender and become who fall kind of biased who approach Krishna.
Yes.
So we understand, so obviously they are superior to who do not approach Krishna, rather they go to some other material means.
Yeah.
And so still they have that material motive in approaching Krishna.
Yeah.
And higher than that are the devotees who do not approach the Lord for any material benefit. So the I was thinking about the verse in Lord Brahma's prayer, Dhankanto, where it's applicable to all the practicing devotees. That is, you know, if there is a calamity happens, understand it is for our purification, it is mercy of the Lord, and still keep going in the devotee service, understanding it as mercy of the Lord. So so that is, even Mahaprabhu in the conversation with Ramananda Roy, when Ramananda Roy quoted this verse, Mahaprabhu said yes, this is pure devotee service. Still he has to go further, but he accepted it as pure devotee service. However, here it is going one step further. That is, Kuntidev is asking for calamity. So can you see this as a step higher than Lord Brahma's presentation on the same calamity?
Well, it's higher in the sense that Queen Kunti feels a more intense attachment to Lord Krishna, and therefore the sorrow of separation, or the feeling of separation from Krishna, is more intense. So she's not necessarily praying for calamities in the sense that she's praying that Krishna doesn't leave them, and that you know, because he was so intensely present when the calamities were there, So she said, well, let the calamities come, you know. If it means you're not going, then, you know, let there be calamity. So in one sense, she's not actually praying, let there be calamities, as much as she's saying, don't go. You know, and if calamities would come and that means you will stay, then let those calamities come. And it is, you know, a progression in that, you know, a devotee, you know, on a certain level practices tolerating the calamities and the difficulties and the obstacles, and they go on with their devotional service. Here, in one sense, you know, Queen Kunti and the Pandavas are saying, what calamities? So, you know, we were just so absorbed in you and associating with you, you know, that somehow if people say they are calamities, let them come again. But, you know, to us, you know, what calamities? We had your association. We, you know, from this we should... actually, Burujam Prabhu, in unveiling his lotus feet, makes a very nice point that, you know, we should understand how sweet is Krishna's association. You know, if you know, you see her prayers that she's saying, you know, your association, Krishna, is so sweet, so nice, you know, our life is so wonderful in your association. That yes, let so many calamities come if that means you will stay. So how sweet is that association, how nice it is. So from, you know, in one sense, from her point of view, you know, the only calamity that she can consider is that Krishna is leaving, you know, and when Krishna is present, it's not really a calamity. Whereas devotees on a lesser platform may be seeing, oh yes, something terrible has happened, you know, even though Krishna is making himself present within the form of his holy name, within the form of the deity, within the form, you know, appearing as the guru and the Vaishnava, you know, and they're still feeling, oh, so many calamities are happening, in one sense, that, and they're trying to tolerate. And they're more focused on the actual calamity and trying to tolerate and deal and go on with their devotional service. They're more focused on that literally than they are focused on Krishna. The Queen Kunti is on a higher platform, that she's more focused on Krishna than the calamities. Yeah, so it is definitely a higher stage. Yeah.
Then, why is she mentioning that?
About the
repeated
birth and the devotees don't have, you know. So that she was no longer free, spiritual birth, and this if the devotees don't ask for, and this understanding, asking for, but she's not necessarily asking for liberation in the sense that she's saying that, you know, Krishna's association, you know, means that the, you know, what is the greatest calamity? Birth and death. Right? She's saying in your association, even the greatest calamities is not present. She's not necessarily praying for, you know, that give me liberation from like that. Any other questions or comments?
The other thing is, you should also need a bit of a consciousness to understand this high devotee's prayer.
Yes.
You can easily misinterpret.
Yes.
Without proper guidance, you know, means as to he just trying to think repeated birth and death. So someone can think, oh, that means, you know, the repeated birth, that means it's calamity, whatever it may be. You know, mm. Assume things.
That's right.
Very easy
yeah.
to go sidetrack.
Yes, that's right. Therefore, you know, these, you know, in Krishna's pastimes, he has certain confidential associates and constant companions, and the Pandavas, and Draupadi, Queen Kunti. Queen Kunti, of course, is has a you know, parental mood with Krishna, although she understands that Krishna is God. Draupadi is a friend of Krishna. Arjuna, all of the Pandavas are actually in a relationship, in friendship with Krishna. Although some, you know, Arjuna is most confidentially and intimately related as a friend amongst the Pandavas. Some there's a little bit more of a tinge of there may be a little mixture with service attitude and friendship, such as I think Bhima and the twins, and but Arjuna is, you know, purely more friendship. So they are amongst when the Lord comes here to this planet, there are many devotees. And amongst them, you know, these out of Vrindavan, these are your most confidential devotees, very, very. So that means that they know the Lord very confidentially, and they know the process of devotional service very confidentially. And as Queen Kunti says in the very beginning, you know, you know, Krishna is just very difficult to understand because he's covered by people seeing him through their material senses. They're seeing him through they're covered by the material energy, you know, which is affecting their, you know, knowledge, affecting their senses, affecting their mood of approaching Krishna. So, you know, people cannot see. But even though we're so covered, if we take that humble mood the Queen Kunti has displayed and hear from the devotees, we can immediately understand these very confidential aspects of Krishna. But you can only, you know, Queen these topics of Queen Kunti. So one devotee is speaking, and then you have to hear from another devotee, you know, what she actually said. Because if you don't hear from another devotee, if you hear from a non-devotee, or even, you know, you know, in one sense, a devotee who may be speculating or not very experienced. You know, you can still not understand. So we have to hear the prayers of Queen Kunti as they are, and this is the beauty of having the purports by Srila Prabhupada, and that's why we're studying them. And of course, so we have those purports, so Prabhupada is the devotee, he's saying this is what Queen Kunti meant, so that's there. But even, you know, to understand that, we have to think about it, we have to meditate upon it, and discuss it. And, you know, if anything shows up, you know, some doubts, or we have to clear it up in the association of devotees like this. If we just sort of, you know, read through those pastimes casually, you know, there's a high chance that, you know, we can certainly misunderstand. Very confidential topics, you know. Yeah. And you can see, you know, we're in the first canto where Sukadeva Goswami is just, really he's just introduced Krishna with a few of his devotees outside of Vrindavan. They haven't got there even close to Vrindavan yet. You know, so much more confidential, so much more difficult to understand. You know, it takes 9 cantos basically to just, you know, start to get a feel of, oh, here's Krishna and, you know, his devotees and how he acts in his various incarnations, and we get a feel, yes, this is God, this is his mission, this is how he executes it according to different places, and this is how he reciprocates with different devotees. Then when we get to the 10th canto, we've got a little bit of tiny little bit of qualification that we can begin, you know, to, and then there's just a qualification to just begin, then, you know, there's a whole lot more work just to really taste, you know, those 10th canto pastimes. Yes.
Birth and death.
Birth and death. She's not praying for liberation, in the sense that she's, you know, what is the greatest calamity? The greatest calamity is, you know, repeated birth and death. Krishna is present, there's no calamities. But to speak of other calamities, and not even, you know, repeated birth and death. So she's saying, you know, the greatest calamity is to not have you, you know, and there's no calamities. You know, the calamities that are there not very important to us, you know, we're just more concerned that you're here. The calamity is if you leave, and you know, if those calamities make you stay, then let them come again.
So that part of it I understood. I mean, here that she said, so long as we will no longer see repeated birth and death, it means that we will no longer see. That's what Prabhu was asking.
Yeah.
For that, you're saying that that's the biggest calamity, so Kunti is not referring to that.
There is an analogy here in the purport of text 25, that a man may see a tiger swallowing him in a dream, and he may cry for this calamity. Actually, there is no tiger and there is no suffering. It is simply a case of dreams. In the same way, all calamities of life are said to be dreams. So, you know, Queen Kunti is saying that even the greatest of calamities, which is birth and death, just doesn't really have any existence any more than a dream in your presence. Why would she pray for liberation when she's already considering that the whole process of birth and death is no more than a dream? You know, someone who's having a nightmare, you know, is saying, you know, wake me, you know, it's like some horrible thing. Oh, the tiger is, you know, going to. But when you're awake, you're sitting there and you think, yes, I'm, there was some dream that a tiger was coming. But you're no longer disturbed because you know it's a dream. So in the presence of Krishna, you know, there is full knowledge, full understanding, and, you know, the calamities of material existence, you know, to the very extreme, the birth and death are just inconsequential. They're no more real than a dream. Yeah. So why would she pray? You know, why would you pray for liberation from something which you consider to be illusory? We pray for liberation because we actually we're an illusion. We're conditioned. Yeah.
generally the focus is on the calamities rather than on Krishna.
Yes. Yes.
It's not about the sweetness of Krishna, but always the
yes, that's because we're on that platform. That's like you're saying. As soon as we read this verse, well, I'm not praying. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to pray for calamities, you know, to come. But you know, her focus is on the sweetness of Krishna. You know, don't go. You know, what calamities? You know, even birth and death is just a, you know, it's like a dream in your presence. It's nothing. You know, when you know, as I said, at the very end of the Mahabharata, you know, Yudhisthira, you know, this wonderful lifetime, right up to the point, you know, walking out in his kingdom and going to the heavenly planets, and you know, he's just meditating upon, you know, just. You know, these wonderful pastimes and how Krishna's, you know, been with them. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead who's accompanied us as our dear friend, our messenger, you know, our charioteer, our servant sometimes, the Supreme Lord. And he's just in ecstasy and he's just looking forward that wherever Krishna goes, you know, I'm just looking forward to going with him, you know. So that means that if, you know, if he is born in another time, you know, it's not a calamity of birth and death. I'm looking forward, you know. So he took birth as a son of Pandu. In his previous to taking birth to the, you know, as a son of Pandu, he would have been just finishing up some other pastime with Krishna and looking forward to the next, you know, time where he could appear and take part in Krishna's pastimes. It's not this horrible, you know, forced to take birth, you know, according to one's karma like that. It's not a question of birth and death. They're just looking forward to being with Krishna, and Krishna will make all arrangements where they appear and disappear. And, you know, birth and death are the greatest calamities. Everything else is, you know, not so much. So, you know, Queen Kunti said, let them come, you know. What's the big deal?
Like
that.
Just another
yeah.
You know how, we're talking to Gopal and Krishna, you know how you're mentioning that when Krishna descends, you know, he comes along with his other, you know, devotees, he
yeah.
descends now. But in the case, just wondering, in the case of Matsya, Kurma, and Varaha,
mm-hmm.
Did he also come down with the devotees?
They have devotees. Yeah, it's not always understood. It's, you know, the sometimes, you know, some details are given, but. Yeah. Well, you know, all of these incarnations reside, you know, in a Vaikuntha planet with their devotees. So, you know, if they need particular devotees to facilitate, you know, their pastimes, then, you know, they will bring them with them. There's no reason why not. Krishna's pastimes are, you know, there are four qualities of Krishna which make him even more superior to Lord Narayan, and one is that he's surrounded by unlimited, you know, wonderful devotees, and another quality is that he enjoys, you know, a great variety of, you know, wonderful pastimes with them. So that's uncommon among the. So they may bring, you know, the odd person, but Krishna is, you know, particularly sweet in, you know, just how many wonderful pastimes and how many devotees surround him. Yeah. You know, it is a unique feature of Krishna. He, of course, is, what's that? Rasamrita, Akila Rasamrita Murti. you know, that's it. What's the English?
He's the reservoir of all rasas.
Yeah. So, you know, therefore, you know, unlimitedly more even than the various incarnations. Alright. So that was a nice discussion on that, but if we were asked in a test situation, you know, and just to take a phrase from Prabhupada's purport, how would you answer that in one line? You know, explain why so-called calamities are welcome. What's that? That's it. It gives us an opportunity to, you know, to remember the Lord. An opportunity to remember the Lord. We don't always get to see Him, but yeah, it'd be good every time something goes wrong, Krishna turns up on your doorstep and, Ganga! What can I do with it? But, we can remember Him. He does turn up, but we can't see Him. And there are some nice analogies there, which about the here, like, you know, one has taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, which we accept the most suitable boat for crossing the ocean in essence, can achieve liberation as easy as one leaps over the holes made by the hoofs of a calf. Such persons are meant to reside in the boat of the Lord, and they have nothing to do with a place where there is danger at every step. So again, you know, it shows Prabhupada is saying the same thing, that, you know, for a devotee who's remembering the Lord, they just, the calamities, the dangers, you know, what's the necessity of asking for liberation or help in one sense, that you just step over those, you know, problems all together like that. Very simple. And then the other analogy, of course, is that they're, you know, illusory, and like a dream. And then, of course, it's stated here, the duty of the same person is to be undisturbed by worldly calamities, which is sure to happen in all circumstances. Suffering of all sorts of unavoidable misfortunes, one should make progress in spiritual realization. That is the mission of human life. You know, the calamities are going to come, whether you pray or not pray. It's the very nature of material existence. They're going to come one after another, and you've really just got to tolerate. A very advanced devotee doesn't consider these calamities to be very much, but if somehow or another the calamities, you know, help them to become more dependent on the Lord than previously there was, then devotees will welcome them, because they know that the Lord reciprocates with that dependency. The more devotee is dependent upon the Lord, the more the Lord will reciprocate with him. So sometimes, and this is where verse 26 comes in, that you know, people can't approach the Lord with that sort of mood of dependency and intensity when they're intoxicated and bewildered by high birth and, you know, opulence, education. So what happens, of course, for us on our platform, you know, the danger is that as devotees, when things go nice and sweetly, our mood of dependency on the Lord and intensity of desiring the Lord's association can waver, and and we enjoy that peaceful situation. A calamity comes and rocks the boat, disturbs all that, and then again we revive that intense mood of dependency on the Lord, and we think, oh, that was a good thing. That calamity was a good thing, because it brought me back to, you know, the real urge of the soul, more so than just, you know, being again a little bit bewildered on the bodily platform, even as a devotee. So in that way, even a devotee will actually welcome calamities, which they're seeing as calamities. They're calamities in the sense that they're becoming a little bewildered, and then you know, enjoying, and something comes and really pulls the rug out from under the feet of what they're enjoying on a mature platform. And then they realize, yes, gee, I had lost that nice feeling of devotion. I'd lost that feeling, you know. Just like the whole world now, they've lost that feeling of devotion to the Lord. If you go back, you know, even 50 or 100 years, you know, it was different. Now, you know, the whole world, they've lost that mood of depending on the Lord and you know, a real feeling of love. It's gone. And therefore, you know, the calamities come, and again, you know, they pray.
Like some people say that if there was a God,
yes,
then why do good people suffer and why do bad people enjoy? What is the best way to answer that question?
Well, they just haven't been caught yet. You know, that's all. It's like a thief who hasn't been caught and punished yet. They're thinking, why be honest? I'm enjoying more than the honest people. You know, then they get caught and thrown in jail. And they're thinking, how stupid I was to think like that. So they're just awaiting to be caught and punished, that's all. They're like... I think most people understand the concept that bad actions will bring a bad result. You know, most people understand that, you know, deep down in their heart. In fact, you know, what's very interesting in Western society is, although people don't believe in reincarnation in one sense, you know, in the Christian world and what have you, there's no reincarnation. You know, you either go after this life, you go to hell, you go to heaven, but there's no reincarnation. And most people, you know, if they don't believe in you know, Christianity, they just don't believe in reincarnation either. Yet, if you watch any Western movie, the bad guy always gets what's coming, and the good guy always gets the girl. Isn't it? And if, no, it's a fact. And if the bad guy is being really bad, when he dies, you know, his death is more painful. If he's done, you watch any movie, you know, if someone does something and they're really nasty to, like, you know, say an elderly lady or, you know, some, oh, you know, when he dies in this movie, it'll be really nasty death like that. So, you know, it's an innate nature of the soul, you know, that they believe that, you know, good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. And although they say they don't believe it, every single book, every single movie, and their whole life is actually based upon that principle, and yet they'll say, I don't believe in it. people who do impious things, thinking that, I don't care, I'll just enjoy now. A good example to say then is that they're like a person who catches a bird and the bird vomits gold. So what they do is they keep making the bird vomit so that they will get the gold, and they kill the bird. That is what it is like to do impious activities so that you will enjoy immediately. you kill the very source of your enjoyment, right? Whereas one who does pious activities, they're they're compared to someone who sells flowers, you know. So they cultivate a tree and they look after the tree, knowing that the tree will continually reward them with flowers. So they're pious, they keep performing pious activities, knowing that they'll continually get the results. So they always look after that tree. So, you know, that is the difference between the mentality of a pious person and an impious person. So you can tell them those analogies, and
just one different point.
Yeah.
You know how, as we were mentioning,
yes,
we can have calamities or difficulties, you know, it's very easy to surrender to Krishna or take his shelter. But on the contrary, we also see in Bhagavatam, there's a person who's quite happy and have got a lot of opulence, but still, you know, he was not really Ambarish Maharaj. He was a king emperor, you know, but still he was slightly, you know, not even.
A devotee doesn't necessarily have to, you know, if a devotee is fixed up in their loving devotional service to Krishna, they don't need that little pinch, you know, by the Lord to bring them back to their senses, you know. That they will, you know, and then other devotees like the Pandavas, they also don't need that pinch, but their performing a pastime to show us a lesson. The Pandavas are a very good example of how a devotee should actually worship the Lord. We see here with Queen Kunti, she's showing a very nice mood that our desire is simply to serve the Lord and always remember him. And you know, we want to always have that close, intimate opportunity to serve the Lord, you know, in a loving relationship. And that is never interrupted by even the greatest of calamities. So the things that happen to the Pandavas in their lifetime, you know, are a millionfold what we will experience in our lifetime, and yet their mood of love for Krishna never wavered. So much so that she is saying that, you know, I would go through it all again, you know, rather than, you know, be separated from you. So, their mood is one that we should follow, but whatever happens, which is difficult, we should our love for the Lord should be really chaste. Therefore we read, was it verse 17, Queen Kunti, you know, is considered to be sati, or a very chaste devotee. So that's what it means to be chaste. So they're, you know, they're an example of you know, a chaste devotee of the Lord. The world is full of unchaste devotees of the Lord. That, you know, so for instance, you know, we know the exact, you know, if we take on a material platform, if a wife is unchaste, as soon as, you know, the husband, there's some problem, oh, I want divorce, you know, or the husband may think, you know, some difficulty with the wife, oh, I want divorce, like this. So that is, you know, not chaste. Prabhupada, you know, gave an example that he saw that you know, there was one woman and her husband was severely disfigured, made him particularly ugly, and you know, sort of decrepit to look at, and you know, like an invalid to some degree. But she, you know, just served him just constantly like a chaste wife and looked after him. And we see also with Gandhari that she, you know, just blindfolded herself, that you know, there's no question of being unchaste. So you know, people appreciate that quality of being chaste. It's like a family. Most families know that, you know, if there's some difficulty in our family, you know, let's stick together, brothers, sisters, mother, father, like this, and we'll work it out, we'll work through it. Not that, you know, there's some difficulty in the family and you're a horrible mother and a father, and you know, you're a horrible brother, and I'm going and packing my bags like this. You know, to be chased. So that same mood, which you know, everyone chased to the country, because now, you know, it's people don't have families, but you know, so it's just nationalism. So you know, maybe the government does that on purpose. You know, they'll make it so hard in this day and age for people to have a family that they adopt their government as a family and try and be chased to them, which is a natural propensity. So anyway, that chastity actually belongs to at the lotus feet of the Lord. And what better example do we get of that chastity than, you know, the Pandavas and Queen Kunti? That whatever happens, you know, we are just fixed at your lotus feet. So much so that let even calamities come again, if it's somehow, you know, if when there's no calamities, if that disturbs our relationship, then bring the calamities. You know, that is the chastity. So we learn that.
What can you do now? Because it's so often the case that when calamities come, you become angry and then you turn away from the issue. So what can we do now when there are no calamities, so that we'll be strong enough when the calamities come?
Well, you know, these should be our heroes. Most people have heroes that, you know, when times are really difficult, they look up to someone who, you know, inspires them. That, you know, and these are our heroes, Queen Kunti. That you know, when things get you know, really tough, we think, you know, how, you know, can I even muster just a, you know, that's what I want to do, but you know, she is the hero, you know, that she, through thick and thin, she just, you know, never wavered. And you know, if we even think like that, if we even have that sort of mentality, then you can guarantee that you'll be protected like that. Yeah. The first thing, of course, is to realize what she did, you know, realize what Queen Kunti did. If we never even think about it, then she doesn't become one of our heroes. You know, then our hero becomes Marge Simpson, or, you know, someone like that. You know, or who are the women heroes in this day and age? Are there any? At all? Are there any women here? You know, I mean, in the Western world, is it? Do they have them?
Julia Gillard.
Yes. Julia Gillard. And what can we learn from Julia Gillard? Don't backstab. So we learn from what she did not to do. Is that it? She doesn't believe in God.
When those politicians commented about the chastity of
some,
they asked him to see allow his child daughter to stay late at night. He said he wouldn't.
Oh, Gandhi?
One of Australian politicians, and it was all over the television. And
okay.
He said, like, how people say this is like old-fashioned conservative. Like,
okay.
Something like that. And he just said normal.
a normal chaste thing. Like, my daughter is not allowed to go outside because she's too young.
Yes. Yeah, that's.
And they said, now how can he act like that? He's, you know, he has to be a role model. He has to let his daughter go out.
That's right. Yeah. It's a fact. We find it hard to find even one hero.
Yeah.
But actually, for the majority of people in society, they're going absolutely, you know, crazy over their heroes. You know, we look and we think, you know, you are insane to be wanting to go into that direction, to be thinking that this person has, you know, anything at all to offer you. You know, here's some mad person living like an animal, you know, just some crazed existence with no principles and no understanding, and misleading people, you know, atrociously, and they're flocking by the thousands. Here's our hero. We find it difficult. But, you know, if we don't hear about what Queen Kunti did, we will never take her as a hero. You know, for instance, if we go through the Bhagavad Gita, we hear, oh, Queen Kunti prayed for calamities. Well, you know, I'm not going there. Next chapter, you know. So, you know, then we look at it again, we think, oh, you know, such chastity, such devotion, such, you know, love, you know, so pure, you know, unmotivated, you know, and we think, gee, you know, if I had even just a fraction of that sort of devotion, you know, you can guarantee that Krishna would be, so happy. So we have to look at these things very carefully. And of course, the other thing here is that, you know, when you've sat in a class like this and you've really looked at, you know, the stature of someone like Queen Kunti, and, you know, just someone, you know, you aspire for that level, that very elevated level of, you know, then when you're amongst the devotees in the congregation and going about your devotional activities, it's very easy to spot when someone's, you know, got a proper mood of devotional service, or where they're, you know, it's very easy to spot the neophytes from the advanced devotees, because you have the standard. But if you don't understand these, you can have no clue. And in most cases, because, you know, we're bewildered by the material energy, we will mistake advanced devotees for insignificant people, and insignificant people for advanced devotees. But when, you know, after really looking at this, it just becomes so obvious, you know, the level of someone's devotion.
Have you heard what is happening to them? Are insignificant people are considered? I'm talking generally. You know, someone will come and they put an orange robe and they put him
in the
thing and they
worship his name. Oh, yes. Yeah. Outside of ISKCON. Let's look at this topic of a Akinchana Gochara, which is covered here as well, that in verse... So there's a couple of things we want to look at. One, how this affects the chanting of the holy name, and the topic of Achincha Gocharam. Explain the meaning of Achincha Gocharam. And alright, who wants to describe the meaning of Achincha Gocharam?
Materially impoverished.
Yeah, materially impoverished. So poverty?
I think it's more, you can be rich, but the point is, you don't think that wealth is yours. So you have, nothing is yours but Krishna.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Because I think his lecture, Gurujan Prabhu said that Srila Prabhupada gave two examples of an akinchana. One was Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj, who also externally had no material possession. And another one was Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Goswami Maharaj, who was very rich.
It was who?
Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Goswami Maharaj, who was very rich, but who didn't think that anything was his.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also Gurudev Prabhu said that Srila Prabhupada described as akinchan.
Yeah. In that lecture, I think the two main people was Srila Guru Kishore Das Babaji and Ramananda Roya. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is mentioned. The first part of that lecture is about Guru Kishore Das Babaji, because he's giving an example of someone who's a Chincha Gochara in the renounced order of life. The second part is really focusing on the fact that Achincha Gotram also applies to Grihasthas. And so the two main persons in that lecture is Guru Kishore Das Babaji and Ramananda Raya, although Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is mentioned casually, as a disciple of Guru Kishore Das Babaji. So, you know, that's what he's highlighting, that Achincha Gotram doesn't mean one who is, just brahmachari, sannyas, like that. Achincha Gotram can apply to grihasthas as well. That means that they don't necessarily, if we want to be Achincha Gotram, does that mean we have to, forego, just have, sometimes you actually see this in ISKCON, that devotees will walk around in, they have one or two devotees, they're very dirty, got a few holes in them, and they're almost, trying to be the Achincha Gotra by being, having no possessions. But actually that's not what it means. It means that they don't depend upon their material possessions. Whether they have them or not is inconsequential. It means that they only depend upon Krishna, and they never think that I don't necessarily have to be so intensely dependent upon Krishna, because if anything goes wrong, of course I have my bank balance and I have a nice car and I have a good job and I have this and that and that. But the Achincha Gotra, even with those things, they will be still feeling completely dependent upon Krishna, and knowing that ultimately, those things, they have a purpose in the service of the Lord, otherwise they're completely useless and will give no protection whatsoever. They know that, unless Krishna protects you, anything else we have will not give us protection at all. They know that, they're convinced. We see there, of course, Srila Prabhupada warning, if we become pound, shilling man, property man, then Krishna will be finished, because Krishna is Achinchana Gochara. There in another lecture he's saying that comfort will be realized only, not Krishna. He says, if we think we have got now a very big house, we should live comfortably and sleep comfortably, the Nagocharam, Krishna will not be realized. So how would we encourage that Achincha Gochara? a kinshan and married within ISKCON. How would we cultivate that?
That's why we always encourage give at least part of your earnings to Krishna, to recognize that what you have is not yours but is Krishna's. So as we keep doing that and caring, then we'll slowly realize that whatever we have is given to us by Krishna and he can take it away as well. So our only shelter is Krishna.
Yes, yes. So we encourage people to not be so dependent on their, you know, wealth, and to give it. Yeah, and to give it, and to see that even after giving it, everything is fine because, you know, Krishna is looking after them. They haven't become, you know, losers in a big way. In fact, you know, we do see that by people giving to Krishna, that they realize that their life becomes, you know, so much more beneficial. That, you know, even every year people give to Janmashtami, and the next year they think, oh, I'm going to give a whole heap more, you know. Mm-hmm. And the next year they think, oh, I'm just going to give so much more, because, you know, in the beginning they think, oh, I'll give a little, you know, little thing of sugar, half a, you know, just take a bit out first. You know, and then they think, no, last year, you know, no, just give more, because they can see it, you know, they're not the losers. I don't have to be so dependent, so, you know, I can actually depend on Krishna, that if I give, it'll be alright. So yeah, it's a fact, by teaching them to give.
Also, you can use all your possessions in the service of the Lord. For example, you can use the house, you know, for preaching.
Yeah, yeah.
You can have
yeah.
programs and, you know, yeah. call people and show that, yeah, I'm also working at the same time, I'm also practicing
the Krishna
consciousness.
That's right.
The
So even the possession, even the things that they're keeping and not necessarily just relinquishing, by using that in the service of Krishna, they also develop that, you know, akinchana, you know, that mood of depending on Krishna. Prabhupada gives a nice example in one of his lectures that when he went to America, you know, basically they had huge material opulence in the West, which all added up to zeros, and therefore, you know, everyone was sad and unhappy and turning into hippies and drugs and, you know, so many crime and so many problems. So you can see all zero, but when you add Krishna, then, you know, the zero becomes 10, 100, like this, it all becomes valuable. So Prabhupada's purpose was never to go to the West and ask them to not be opulent. He went to the West and said, keep your opulence, but at the moment, because you're not using it for Krishna, it adds up to zero. Be opulent. You have the ability to earn so much money and to, you know, create so much wonderful facility. Do that, just like Krishna. He never went there and said, live like they do, you know, in India. Yeah, certainly, you know, there's simple living and high thinking, but it doesn't mean that they're, even with simple living and high thinking, still, you know, they become very opulent, you know, by, we see in Vedic times, by the majority of people, cow protection, you know, agriculture, still they're very, very opulent compared to now. You know, even ordinary people had, you know, jewelry and gold and silver and coins. You know, even in Prabhupada's childhood, he mentions, you know, you want rice, you know, you just... for a small amount you get so much rice. At last year, his father used to buy rice to last 1.5 years at a time. It's really cheap, you know, and always fruit and mangoes and you know, just an opulence. Now the same place, and you become very, very impoverished. So it's not as if simple living, high thinking means, you know, that they become somehow poverty-stricken or impoverished in that sense. It's actually a very opulent lifestyle. You've got the best of food, you know, the best of clothing, massive amounts of time to enjoy life. You know, I always look at these paintings that the women have on their hands and that, and you think, yeah, how opulent are you? You're like some multi-millionaire, you know, that you can sit down and just idle away time and just paint these designs. You know, it's an opulence. And my oldest daughter's, her when she was going to university, you know, her friend said, "Is your father a millionaire?" Or this, you know. She goes, "No. Why would you think that?" She said, "He just has so much time." You know, it's like, you know. So, you know, because I was able to, you know, pop in and pop in here and pop in there, and you know, where most people, it's like, you know, "Oh no, you know, where's your father? He can't come. He's at work, and he's got overtime tonight. This, that, and the other." So, you know, they thought that because I just, you know, wandered around sort of as if I had nothing to do, which I do most of the time, that I was a millionaire. You know, but in essence, you know, as a devotee, you live like a millionaire. You know, you walk in, "Oh, look at this prasad," and you know, you sit down, and so much. You know, and look at the mansion that we're, you know, here. Beautiful gardens, we've got caretakers out there. you know, it's millionaires don't have the lifestyle of some of the average devotees. You know. So,
there are some devotees who spend a lot of money on travel expenses to go to holy places.
Yeah.
But when they go to the holy place, they are not able to give the Lord anything. So they say, "He has spent a lot of money." But actually, if you look at it, the expenses have gone in their travel comforts. And nothing has gone to the Lord.
Yeah.
Instead, just going to the holy place, that's okay.
No, we shouldn't turn up empty-handed on the Lord's doorstep. We should, you know, there should be some provision, you know, for travelling to holy places. You know, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura chastised his disciples when they were travelling through the holy Dharma, that they weren't giving, the pilgrims were, you know, or, you know, some of the people were holding their hand, you know, to give them something, and they were saying, "No, our money is for Krishna," like this. And he chastised, you know, that, you know, "In the name of devotional service, you're maintaining miserliness within your heart." So he didn't like that. And he said that what will happen is if you maintain that attitude, your heart will become hard. And what will happen is that eventually that hard-heartedness will creep into your devotional service, and then you'll become miserly with the Lord as well. That weed will grow. So we have to be careful of these things, yeah, definitely.
But you know, that's a little bit tricky, because there are people there, we don't know, see, who they're giving, they're not encouraged to give it to those people. They're saying, "Give it to the Lord." When you give to the Lord, automatically the temple process that happens, I mean, they will get benefit, but we don't know what they are doing with the money.
I know, with when I found,
even there, there are so many, like even in Sakshi Gopal, there are so many people there. They said, "Don't give it to them." That's the instruction. Is it wrong then?
I know, when I look, you have to take all these things with a little intelligence. Everything should be utilized in the service of the Lord to make people favourable to devotional service. I know when I travel around with my spiritual master Indrajuna Swami, that, you know, if there's some little children, you know, busking or something, he will stop the kirtan and ask the devotee for a cup of dal, and he will put something in their plate, and those little children, you know, look up and they think, "These Hare Krishnas are great." And that person has just, you know, Krishna will, you know, remember that as soon as they have one nice thought. And of course, if your first thought of the Hare Krishnas is something good, it will progress from there. If your first thought is something, the miserly, you know, this. So first impressions, you know, they last, and they're very important. We spend, you know, thousands of dollars in some of our preaching. You know, and sometimes they do member, and they're thousands of dollars. They do up the restaurant, you know, 40,000 here, 50 there, you know, like that. And someone says, "Oh, you're going to give a dollar to a little girl in the street, and she's going to say, 'These Hare Krishnas are great,' and somehow that's misusing money." And how does that make sense? Or, you know, a pilgrim, you know, they see these nice devotees coming from overseas, and they're kind, they're charitable, they're nice people. You know, a couple of dollars here and there, what does it matter? You know, and but here, you know, we have opulence. We spend 10,000 on this and 20 on that. You know, to preach to, you know, some with sometimes just limited result, and sometimes even people, you know, criticize for, you know, that they may even come away with a bad impression. That, oh, you know, just, you know, like Srila Prabhupada, they, you know, would like to pick him up in a Rolls Royce or something, and people thought, oh, you know, what is this, spending so much money? Yeah, which is a good question. How can we distinguish, in one sense, that, you know, as it states here, that you know, let's think of other alternative attitudes to the Akinchana mood which has crept into ISKCON that we may have seen. Who can give some examples? Alright, so in other words, you know, devotees becoming, you know, pounds and shillings people, more interested in living a good life as a devotee, and rather than, you know, and being attracted to the you know, facilities and opulences, rather than, you know, just, you know, having that that desire that, no, all I want is Krishna, you know, these other things mean nothing to me. If I have them, I use them all for Krishna. If I don't have them, you know, it doesn't matter. All I want is Krishna. You know, to the alternate, of course, is that, no, I'm, you know, I like this comfortable, you know, this facility. How do we, you know, who can think of different ways? Not necessarily here, of course, this temple, you don't see any of that, but, you know, other temples? Or here, you know, I don't know if anyone's seen anything here. You don't have to mention names. But just, you know, or even in ourselves, what do we see? Something which is not quite right, with perhaps, you know, proper guidance, things we'd be, you know, we'd be thinking, oh gee, if things go that way, that wouldn't be a good thing for ISKCON. What sort of examples do you think? He keeps getting saying, you've got all the answers. His management.
Management. Right. Reaching his feet,
then,
it's more attractive to the facilities.
Yes, yeah, that's that.
There's less dependency on the
government. Yeah, in one sense, that in order for preaching to be really going on, there must be a lot of money and facility provided. Otherwise, somehow, the preaching is not really going on, or people, you know, devotees are not really interested. Yeah, that's a good example. And yeah, do you want to elaborate more on that? Is that other one? Anyone else want to discuss anything more on that point?
Because the preaching by someone else, because of preaching, the facilities come. Because people come, people donate, so because of preaching, facilities come.
Yeah.
And one can get attached to the facility,
yeah,
and then forget the preaching.
Yes, yeah, that's a fact. And, yeah, that's a fact. So, you were going to say? Something? Who had their hand up? Did you have your hand up before? No. Other examples? Management is looking your way now, so you have to do. Look at the ladies being quiet the last few minutes. This is, you know, it's. What's that?
The people who are devotees, they are behaving in a manner that's not supposed to be acceptable.
Yeah.
That it all the more sort of reflects on people who are coming newly. You say that that these people are not really Krishna conscious. They are more.
Yeah.
Depending on the behavior of the person.
Yeah. It's a fact that what happens, of course, is that when a new person comes, if they see, especially the senior devotees, that the qualities of a senior devotee is that, what accompanies being a senior devotee is a lot of facility. Alright? So if a younger devotee comes and thinks, if I look at the hierarchy of devotees, you know, the more advanced senior the devotee, the more facility they have. You know, so yes. Yeah, that's well. It's well. The thing is, what I'm saying is that the senior devotees are behaving in such a way that they're, senior devotees or ISKCON itself is behaving in such a way that it's, you know, that can be there. So those new devotees will come along and think that for me to become recognized as a senior devotee, I must have office, good pair of shoes, good car, good computer, good that, nice fancy chatter. What's that?
iPhone.
Yes, the iPhone.
Two wheeler.
What's that?
Two wheeler.
A two wheeler, yeah. So it sounds funny, but you see that sometimes in different places, and even here sometimes, that when young devotees have come along and they think, you know, I've been around for a year now, people should start appreciating that I'm capable of doing some big things in ISKCON. So they want to make a stance as an elder, you know, a senior devotee, and they will do it by way of the facility and the clothes and an attitude and a walk. And another thing which, you know, part of the opulence of being a senior devotee in some temples, not here of course, is not actually having to do any work. So a younger devotee will then think that, you know, in order to manifest my seniority, I just have to start knocking back, you know, all this work, which is really meant for the, you know, the punters, you know. So, you know, things like that can happen. They do happen. They happen even here. They happen everywhere. But, you know, they're examples of how the opposite of the akinchana mood can creep in. What happened in the Gaudiya Math?
They became attached to the big temple that
and you know, how many, you know, the majority of his men were sannyasis. You know, so, you know, we shouldn't be surprised and think, oh, it's not going to happen here. I mean, you know, the majority of us are grihasthas. You know, grihasthas are renowned for, you know, sort of, you know, collecting and, you know, kind of expanding facility. You know, more so than sannyasis. But here we see in the Gaudiya Math, the movement of so many sannyasis, they, you know, their devotional service become dependent upon the facility. Otherwise, how can I go on as a guru without this facility and without so many, you know, like this, and without the recognition and, you know, the titles and like that. So it can happen. Very, very dangerous. So it's such a nice mood here with Queen Kunti. This is the real devotee. You know, these are the real devotees. And again, you know, people think that, you know, if I walk around looking something like a sannyasi, you know, I've got my wooden clogs and, you know, this, that and the other, and, you know, and giant beads, and, you know. There are different things that devotees do to somehow want to look like it. But here, you know, this humble woman, Queen Kunti, is actually showing, you know, here is a real devotee, the real mood of a devotee. And you're actually better off to follow Queen Kunti than to show by the sannyasi. And that's the fact of it. You know, or someone who, you know, who claims to be, you know, very senior, elevated devotee, who has a different mood. So these are very important to be able to recognize for the benefit of ISKCON. And of course that's, you know, the whole reason we're doing these classes, because, you know, the devotees that attend this course, you know, when they come out, they will be bhakti vaibhavis. And bhakti vaibhavi, as I said in the very beginning, it is something, you know, quite significant. You know, the bhakti vaibhavis are the ones that really, their mood of devotion, their advice, their preaching methods, their example, you know, should be foremost in people's minds, because they have taken a very serious look at what is ISKCON meant to be, and you know, they're learning this and trying to practice it in their own lives. So it's very, not just a piece of paper, it's very, very important. And you'll find that those who take the trouble to do it, you know, there's a couple of years, we said 2 years, maybe extend that a little bit, but those who take the time to do it, and they do it properly, Krishna will definitely utilize your newfound elevation in understanding of the process of devotional service and abilities. You know, Krishna will definitely take them and utilize them.
It takes a while to actually realize it, because when I was doing Bhakti Shastri, we were repeatedly told that now we're just getting an overload of knowledge.
Yes.
But it would take a lifetime to process it and understand and realize and practice it. So isn't that the same with Bhakti Vaibhav? Like, we may go through the course in 1 year, 2 years, but that's just knowledge which by devotional service and by association is gradually realized.
I think today, you know, we've looked at something more than just knowledge. You know, we haven't even covered all the verses, but just picking up on Queen Kunti's mood of, you know, chastity, and you know, to Krishna alone, without wanting any, you know, she's not after peaceful life or opulence or what have you. So we're sort of looking at the value that a devotee places on that chastity to Krishna. So that's first to understand what the value is. So I think, you know, everyone here got some idea. So we've understood something more clearly than was before, rather than Queen Kunti's prayers, you know, she's praying for calamities, you know. So let's move on. So the understanding of the value is there. Who appreciates that value? You know, who likes what we've, you know, what, yeah, as something, you know. I think if you hear a value that you really admire, you're definitely going to put it into use, you know, to some, you know, according to the, you know, different devotees will utilize it and become mature in utilizing that value quicker than others, for certain. But you would say, as a group, that value, you know, will has become enhanced, and you know, most of you walk out here today, you know, with just a clearer conception of being chaste devotee of the Lord.
To apply it takes a little bit of time.
Really?
You may know it, but to apply it really, I mean, like for example, I don't want to name the devotee, this senior devotee. I mean, he used to say, he used to make a mockery of himself.
Yes.
That itself shows his greatness.
Yes.
Because the very fact he used to make, he could mock himself.
Right.
He used to mock himself. He used to say that, look, when I have a job, I have no time. I am so busy. But when I have time, when I've lost a job, I'm having time and I'm thinking, oh, I can nicely read Bhagavatam and I can nicely utilize it. I can go and preach. But at that time, I'm always worrying, oh, I don't have a job. I need to get a job. I need to get a job.
Right.
He's mocked himself. Right. Look, I'm not able to depend on Krishna. But look, I'm. So, I mean, at least I feel that he has gone a step in realizing that, look, I'm not like this. This is where I should be.
What was he teaching?
He used to take part in preaching.
Yeah, Bhakti Shastri? Did you do Bhakti Shastri? Yeah.
No, but what I'm saying is, the devotee, he actually, I would say, he's still a step up. He is understanding that, look, I should be like this, but I'm not like this. Why I'm not like this? I should not worry about my job. He could help it, but at least he's thinking about it, he's realizing it, and he used to mock himself in front of others. Look, this is what I should be doing, but I'm not able to do it. So I feel that at least he's that much realized. But for us to realize it is something different than reading it. The calamity comes to us.
Yep, so that's a valid point. So some people take the knowledge, and we see many years later, they're, you know, having difficulty putting it into practice. Let's take ISKCON as a whole. Okay. Most people walk through the doors of a temple, you know, coming from a life of who cares about God? There may be something there, you know, some conception of God, usually not very clear, and there's some lip service and what have you. But if you take ISKCON as a whole, and you consider their chastity to God, and compare that even with, you know, other so-called religions, you know, I think you'd have to say that they really are taking these values as a whole, as a movement, quite nicely.
This is an ISKCON
movement. Yeah, no.
The devotee,
yeah. Look, for instance, here, like, we have Janmashtami. So, you know, massive, you know, so many devotees. So many devotees will be, you know, pouring out so much time and effort. And a lot of these people, if you go back, you know, some of them 6 months or a year or a few years, they didn't care about God at all. They're just business, business, business. Now, you know, they're, you know, there's some chastity that value is there. I think that they, you know, that as we said, they wouldn't want someone comes this year, we're asking again, you give a donation to ISKCON, and they know, gee, I wouldn't want to not give. That would be unchaste to Krishna. You know, he's right there. I think if you take the movement as a whole, this is good, but if we want to be able to protect our ever expanding movement and protect our own devotional service, and, you know, make our center and our service, you know, we say, you know, first class, you know, a real shining example, then in order to do that, we you know, need to follow that. So I would say the values are there in ISKCON, and there are exceptions, and there are many devotees who certainly, you know, don't even understand Queen Kunti's prayers, and there are many senior devotees, you know, who don't understand her chastity and her devotion.
Yeah. But
applying it.
Well, apply, yeah, many of them don't understand, let alone apply it. And there are some who understand it and still can't apply it. No, it's a fact. It's there. I wouldn't say it's, you know, we've got an epidemic problem in ISKCON or the temple. You know, we were looking at a few examples, you know, and sort of making some of it up as we go. But we have to be careful, of course, that something doesn't become, you know, some temples literally close down because the devotees fight over the facility. And they've lost the mood of chastity and just, you know, kinchi gocha to Krishna. And I've been in temples where, you know, the whole temple, you know, beautiful, wonderful temple like this, and next thing, you've got 80 devotees who hate each other. I've seen it. I've seen it happen. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we, you know,
is it ISKCON temples before?
Yeah, ISKCON.
ISKCON
temples. Yeah. So, and as we said, it happened in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura's mat. So, we have no option. One is to, if we want to be a nice devotee, we should at least understand this value, and to the degree that we can apply it, that's glorious. And if we want to do something valuable for our temple, our zone, then we should spread that mood, the proper mood of being a devotee. And you know, if we see, as it said, one of the things is that when you really spend this amount of time as we have in looking closely at the nice chaste mood of a devotee, then it becomes so much easier to spot the difference or spot what's missing. There's no doubt about it. Not that you know, we all race out of the door and we start looking around the temple and saying, oh, you know,
we should look at ourselves.
You should look at it. We can also look at the other devotees, but we should, you know, follow that humble mood of Queen Kunti, you know, and gentle, and you know, the you know, with anything that people learn, you know, most teachers know, of course, you teach the students something, they race out the door and, you know, they want to just utilize that knowledge even though they don't quite understand it. So, you know, you have to be careful of that. But,
so, do we understand from this that a chaste, that a real devotee thinks that only Krishna, pleasing Krishna, has any value? Everything else, whether it's wealth or freedom from birth and death, really has no value.
Yeah, that's their only goal, is to please Krishna.
Could you categorize that as
nathanam, 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 nathanam? Yeah, that's the mood, the real mood of sannyas, is to, you know, in the shishastikam, that they're not after followers or wealth or, you know, this side or the other. Again, as we describe, we have to be careful that we don't stereotype what is an akinchana gocha devotee, that there's someone who walks around in a dhoti, you know, that's got pot stains all over it and, you know, so many holes you know, they have, you know, and they go out on sankirtan looking very disheveled. And I remember I was on the farm, and there was a family who used to live there in a little cottage, the whole family. Husband, wife, three children, three boys. And after that family left, whenever people would come down to my house, we would walk past this little cottage, and I try not to say anything about it, and if they ask me, they go, oh, did someone live there? I go, yeah, someone lived there. I try not to give too many details, because if I said, you know, a whole family, you know, of you know, two adults, three children lived in that little shed, they would just, they would like, you know, oh, you know, it, yeah, oh, so that's what a, you know, devotee is, you know, supposed to live like and what have you. They were really disturbed. It wasn't very attractive for people who went to the farm. It was actually a real turn off for them. So we have to be careful, you know, we have to understand the real meaning of a kinchana. Attachment to Krishna does not mean that we give up all our possessions, we don't have any possessions. It means that whether we have possessions or no possessions is irrelevant. You know, whatever Krishna sends, we will utilize in his service. And our only motive in serving Krishna is to please him in a favorable way. And we're not concerned with what facility may result from that service. At the same time, if, again, we have to be very careful of being critical, ISKCON is going to have to mature to the point where, you know, many of the full-time devotees are able to perform their service and quite comfortably live from the facility that, you know, is generated from that service. We can't, you know, it's not practical in one sense to, what can happen is that if we take people who are professional people and literally take away their livelihood, you know, the results of their education, they spend 100% of their time trying to please Krishna to the point where they sabotage their own ability to maintain themselves, and then when that's happened and they're in difficulty and they can't come to the temple and serve, then we say, oh, they're my, you know, we don't see them very much. You know, we have to, ISKCON literally has to be able to set devotees up in such a practical service that that devotee is giving, you know, such a wonderful contribution in many ways to ISKCON, and at the same time their maintenance is taken care of. We should not begrudge. You know, no, you're giving 100% of your time, yeah, we're enjoying, but you know, when you have destroyed your own ability to maintain yourself, even your health, then, you know, we're not interested, we just go to the next devotee. So like we have a whole bunch of expendable devotees, you know, that's not the sort of movement, that's not the meaning of a kinchana, you know. So we have to properly understand what does it mean. It means the devotees, you know, they're attached to Krishna, but they have firm faith. Yes, Krishna will maintain and protect me. And if Krishna does maintain and protect his devotees, we should not begrudge that. You know, ISKCON should be able to support. You know, it's very difficult. You see, brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, they, you know, do so much service, and then when it comes time, they get married. And all of a sudden you're on your own. But you know, they've given the years of their life where they would have been getting an education, some work experience, or spending some time developing a relationship. They've foregone all that for ISKCON, and then, you know, they want to get married. Okay, now you're on your own. You can't, you know, that's not the sort of a kinchana gotra quality that we want in ISKCON. So in other words, we should be able to see that some devotees have this much facility and some devotees have this much facility. They're using everything nicely in Krishna's service, and through that service they're also being maintained nicely, but their real goal is to please Krishna. Automatically their maintenance is there. Not that, you know, if someone, if devotees are somehow you know, maintained through the service, that we would automatically conclude that that person cannot be a kinchana gotra. There's some real dangers in misunderstanding these verses. You know, there's some real dangers. So you're very, very careful, you know, to have the proper understanding. Otherwise, it is so easy to wreak havoc within a community. Especially when a senior devotee, you know, all of a sudden gets some, you know, strange misunderstanding of the philosophy and starts pushing that out into the community, it's amazing how it can tear a community apart. You know, because it means that nice devotees are being labelled as something not so nice because of a misapplication of philosophy, and senior devotees, you know, who don't appear to be senior externally but according to their Krishna consciousness, being mistreated, you know, that can happen very easily. And it does happen, and even around the world there are certain temples where it's happening now. We don't want it to happen here.
I'm not sure how relevant this is, but I spoke with one of the ladies who's coming to Crossways to this Urban Yoga lecture stay, and she mentioned that she went, after coming there some time, she went to a farm.
Yes.
And she said, what I experienced, she said, first of all, I was thinking like, I have to sleep separate from my husband. That was shock for her. But what shocked her is that she saw one of the devotees being somehow isolated by the other devotees.
Yes.
She was recognizing them as temple devotees.
Yes.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Temple, but anyway, she perceived them as such.
Yes.
And she said, I was shocked that they were fighting all the time over that weekend.
Yes.
And later I noticed that they went away, and she said, I just lost taste for coming.
Yes, no, it's a fact.
And it took her a long, long time to come back again.
Yeah. But to speak of new people, even, you know, very senior devotees sometimes will give up and go away in disgust, because they can be surrounded by so many people misusing Prabhupada's philosophy and creating hell somewhere in some, you know, part of ISKCON. It happens.
But I guess, yeah, knowing this, maybe developing the mood, you can then understand that you should avoid, at least in the public, doing such things.
Yeah.
You are representing, yeah, the ISKCON itself. So even if you have the reason for fight, you should at least, you know, tell the person, you know, how people discuss this, or, you know, can we go outside or something like that, not doing it in front of people who are not sensitive.
Yeah. Yeah. But it shows you what happened, you know, when things go wrong. Things can go, you know, one's intelligence can completely, you know, disappear very quickly. I've seen, you know, temples, you know, driven to the point of hating everybody. You know, each devotee hates every other devotee.
And then the people stop coming.
Yeah. Because
they see they
So look, let's we've actually discussed the main things that we wanted to discuss. We're not going through the content. We're not necessarily just, you know, covering it all just for the sake of gathering knowledge, what have you. We've looked at some really nice values today, which is good. That was the main thing. Just let me summarize the last few verses in one sense, that Queen Kunti, you know, what are other people saying about why you took birth? You know, some say it's to glorify, you know, this king, some say it's this reason, that reason. A thread through Prabhupada's comments and lectures on all of these is that basically they're saying apparently different things, but it's the same thing what Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, that he comes to deliver the devotees, annihilate the miscreants, and re-establish the principles of religion. And on that point, he doesn't personally have to come to annihilate the miscreants. And the devotees, in one sense, are already delivered. He comes for his pastimes. He doesn't have to come. He doesn't actually personally have to come to deliver the devotees. They're actually already delivered because they're devotees situated. He doesn't have to come and personally kill the non-devotees. He can just send a couple of waves and a couple of storms. They're all dead. You know, the world of their intelligence, they'll all kill each other. He comes for his pastimes, and in that way he gives great pleasure to his devotees out of his kindness and mercy. And while he's here, he establishes religious principles and annihilates the miscreants, and out of his mercy, and protects the devotees while he's here. It's a pastime. He doesn't necessarily have to come and do that. Yeah.
I've always had a question about that, because even his devotees, often he sends his devotees here.
Yeah.
So it seems, at least to me, that he comes basically to establish the principles of religion, because his devotees, he sends them here, or if they have just become purified, he can just take them back to the spiritual world. So it seems that he comes basically to establish the principles of religion.
Well, when Krishna comes, personally, or he sends his devotees, it's the same thing. When a devotee comes, that means Krishna has come. If Krishna sends his devotee, just like, if there was some trouble in a province and the queen sends, her emissary, go and fix that problem. That means the queen's taken care of it. Otherwise, she could say, "I don't want to know. I want to fix that problem." So, the people are there. Yes, the queen is fixing the problem here, and she sent this person. It is actually the same thing; they're non-different. And when the devotees are there, that means Krishna is there. When Krishna kills the demons, or the devotees kill the demons on his behalf, they get the same result. Let me just summarize something else, that in the prayers of Bhishma summarizes the calamities of the Pandavas in this way, that don't be disturbed because you are executing your duties to Krishna. There's nothing to lament in that. And whatever happened, happened by under the purview of time. And time represents the will of the Lord. So therefore, it's not a result of your sinful activities, Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira is very worried. It's not a result of your, it happened under the purview of time, which represents the will of the Lord. When you say the purview of time, it means the will of the Lord. Yudhisthira was following the will of the Lord, so it's not sinful. And those who weren't following the will of the Lord, under time they were punished. There's a nice way, you can say when devotees are suffering, you say to someone, you're getting a reaction, for being a rascal. That's your karma, because devotees, in one sense, it's not applicable. But, you can say what Bhishma Dev said, that, this is all happening under, the purview of time. Why am I suffering? It's all happening under the purview of time. So it's a nice way of saying, because you're not saying, oh, this is your karma, like this. It's the will of the Lord, because you're such a nice devotee. So, knowing that everything is happening by the will of the Lord, one should follow the will of the Lord, because there's no alternative, of course. If you don't follow the will of the Lord, you get punished, as Jiradan and the others did, having everything taken off them and becoming infamous for all time to come. And if you do follow the will of the Lord, then all blessings are there. So, We'll look at next week, you know, some of Yudhisthira's reasons, you know, why he felt bad after the battle of Kurukshetra, and why Krishna got him to approach Bhishma. So what I'd like you to do, while you're in a studious mood, read all the rest of chapter 8 and chapter 9. At least read the translations, at least do that. You can go through some purports. If you've got any questions, write them down. We're going to discuss it over 2 more weeks, and it's good if you're familiar with all of it. And then a third week from now, we're going to go over the whole unit and just make sure we've got a really clear understanding in preparation for the test. Alright. Thank you for your attention. It'll be 4 weeks to test.